Today's Tay Show will be on Case 1, and in the long con, Joe Shu's move. A monk asked Joe Shu, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" Joe Shu answered, "Mu." Mumon's comment, "In order to practice Zen, you must pass the barrier of the ancestors. To attain this subtle realization, you must completely cut off the way of thinking. If you do not pass the barrier and do not cut off the way of thinking, then you will be like a ghost clinging to bushes and weeds. Now, I want to ask you, what is the barrier of the ancestors? Why, it is this single word, mu. That is the front gate to Zen. Therefore, it is called the Mumonkan of Zen, the gateless barrier of Zen. If you pass through it, you will not only see Jiaozhou face to face, but you will also go hand in hand with the successive ancestors, entangling your eyebrows with theirs, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. Isn't that a wonderful possibility? Wouldn't you like to pass through this barrier? Arouse your entire body with its 360 bones and joints and its 84,000 pores of the skin. Summon up a spirit of great doubt and concentrate on this word, mu. Carry it continuously, day and night. Do not form a nihilistic conception of vacancy or a relative conception of has or has not. It will be just as if you swallowed a red-hot iron ball, which you cannot spit out even if you try. All the illusory ideas and delusive thoughts accumulated up to the present will be exterminated. And when the time comes, internal and external will be united. You will know this, but for yourself only, like a dumb man who has had a dream. Then all of a sudden, an explosive conversion will occur and you will astonish the heavens and shake the earth. But it will be as if you snatch away, it will be as if you snatch away the great sword of the valiant general, Kan Wu, and hold it in your hand. When you meet the Buddha, you kill him. When you meet the ancestors, you kill them. On the brink of life and death, you command perfect freedom. Among the sixfold worlds and the four modes of existence, you enjoy a playful and happy samadhi. Now I want to ask you again, how will you carry it out? Employ every ounce of your energy to work on this move. If you hold it without interruption, behold, a single spark and the sacred light is ignited. Mumon's verse, the dog, the Buddha nature, the pronouncement, perfect and final. Before you say it has or has not, you are a dead person on the spot. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning. I'm sitting with so much determination in spite of many obstacles. Thank you so much for making such an excellent effort. So, if you have been practicing Zen for a while, you know all about Mu. It's the first koan in the Mumonkan. And there's definitely a reason why this is so. As Master Mumon, Master Wu Men, says, Wu Men, He says, this is the gate to awakening. Unless you go through this door, you will never wake up. So in our tradition of Zen practice, we sit in emptiness, and we practice Mu. You know, we have been reading in our group the Diamond Sutra. We have our study group on alternate Sunday nights. And we have been reading the Diamond Sutra. And I don't know if you've had a chance to read the Diamond Sutra, but it's a really a strange sutra. You know, we've been reading in our group some of the early Pali Sutras. And the early Pali Sutras are dialogues. If you are a fan of philosophy, you might have read in college like a Platonic dialogue, Plato's dialogues, and Socrates has a debate with somebody. The Pali Sutras are a little bit like the dialogues of Plato. They're written in a very straightforward style, and you know, basically the Buddha, it will say the, thus have I heard, you know, I heard the teachings of the Buddha, I witnessed the Buddha say these things. That's how the sutras start. Thus have I heard. And basically in early Buddhism, all the Buddha's teachings were collected and in this body of sutras. And, you know, to testify to the authenticity of the sutras, they start out with somebody, a monk, saying, thus have I heard. And then they'll relate, you know, the world-honored one, the Buddha, went here, and he did this, and he met this person. And this person asked him this question, and the Buddha answered in this way. All these sutras work the same way. And, you know, actually, after the Buddha died, all these monks got together, and they actually had like a council. And they got together and they all compared notes. Some of them remembered the same conversations. And anyway, there were a large number of monks whose job was just to remember the teachings. They would actually, you know, they had incredible memories, and they would recite sutras for people, for other monks and for lay people. And eventually, after about 400 years, all of these were still in circulation. People had much better memories than we do today, and they would get together, and there were like sutra specialists, and they would recite it was called the Buddha Vakana, the words of the Buddha, Buddha Vakana. They were the bearers of the Buddha Vakana, the Buddha's precious teachings, and they would get together and they would recite the Buddha Vakana. And these were collected about 400 years after the Buddha's death and written down in Pali, and later in Sanskrit. Okay. So anyway, all of these sutras are very straightforward. You know, they will say the Buddha was going into the town of Savatthi, and he met so and so, and they'll identify who it was, and they'll say he asked the Buddha this question, and the Buddha answered this. And often the dialogues end with the person going, you know, that's really interesting. You know, I believe you. I'd like to become a follower of yours. And some of them became monks and nuns, and some of them become lay followers, right? And it often happens, but it doesn't always happen. Sometimes people say, no, I'm sorry, I can't buy that. And they don't accept it, or they're non-committal, right? But when you get to the later sutras, the sutras in the Mahayana, this is a later Buddhism. Zen belongs to the Mahayana. The sutras are very different. You know, they weren't transmitted orally, they were written down. And they're very different in spirit also. And one of the most important of these early Mahayana sutras was called the Diamond Sutra. And, you know, we've been reading the Diamond Sutra, and it's such a strange book, right? It has a little bit of the kind of flavor of the early Buddhist sutras, but right away, the Buddha is saying strange things. It's you know, the Buddha's starting to speak in like riddles, and at first you don't think they're riddles, but as you read the sutra, it becomes more and more strange. What the Buddha's saying becomes more and more strange, and contradictory. Right? So. At one point, the Buddha says, you know, if you make an offering, a gift to somebody, you know, you should make it without the expectation of any reward. See, and you say, oh, I get that, right? When you give without expecting anything in return. But then the Buddha goes on and he says, actually, there is no such thing as a gift. And there's no such thing as a giver, and there's no such thing as a receiver of a gift. And then it's like, well, what did we just do? I thought we gave a gift, and now you're telling me there's no gift, and there's no receiver, and there's... And the sutra goes on and on like this. The Buddha will say, he will say to Subhuti, this monk he's talking to, did the world-honored one come here to help other people wake up? And Subhuti will go, oh yes, you did, world honored, when you came here to wake up. And the Buddha will say, you're absolutely right, I came here to help people wake up. However, there's actually no such thing as a person who wakes up. So the sutra is very strange. It's almost as though if you were reading a book of the Bible and Jesus said, I come here to bring forgive you for your sins and bring everlasting life. See, everybody would go, okay, that sounds great. But then if Jesus in the Bible said, however, there are actually no such thing as sins, they're merely called sins, and there's actually no such thing as eternal life, it's merely called eternal life. Now you would be, you know, people would be very upset, right? And this teaching was, this sutra was actually quite upsetting to early Buddhists. See? And it's possible to read the Diamond Sutra many times and be totally baffled about what it's doing. See? Because the Buddha will say something. He'll say, I have come to liberate people from their illusions. And then they'll say, however, there's really no such thing as liberation, and there's really no such thing as people. Okay, so all of this is puzzling and baffling, and yet, you know, the interesting thing is, when people, the Diamond Sutra is really like a treasured sutra. You know, people, when they read the Diamond Sutra, they understand maybe 8%, right? They understand something's going on here, you know. And the Buddha basically is talking to Subhuti, and he's telling him these things. He's saying, yes, I do this, but I don't really do it. I am the Buddha, but I'm just called the Buddha. People read this and, you know, they don't understand it intellectually, but the interesting thing is it's an incredibly beloved sutra. And when you read the sutra, if you read it straight through, or if you read it in installments, you know, at the end of it, I defy you not to feel freer, not to feel liberated, not to feel energized. And it operates on this like subconscious level that the early Buddhist sutras don't even try to do, right? When you read some of these Mahayana sutras, you know, it's like they baffle your thinking mind with paradoxes and contradictions. And, you know, we hate not understanding things, right? We want to understand things. So if you say, what are the three jewels in Buddhism? Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. If you say, you know, what are the four noble truths, you know, and you lay out, what is the noble eight, all this makes total sense, right? But what the Diamond Sutra is doing is really different. What it's doing is it's saying, I'm going to say things to you that don't make much sense intellectually. And you're going to go from one chapter to the next. And you're going to start reading thinking, this is going to make sense to me. And then by the end of the chapter, you won't really know what was just said, but you'll feel more free. See, that's how this sutra works. And, you know, I've been reading the Diamond Sutra for like 50 years, right? And when I first read it, I just didn't understand it. And then I began to read it with commentaries, like scholarly commentaries. And, you know, then I realized, you know, it really doesn't matter, you know, if we're using Red Pine's translation. And he's very learned. He knows all of Indian tradition, all of Chinese tradition, and the sutra is like 15 pages and the book is like 400 pages because it's all his commentaries and references to Indian philosophy and Chinese philosophy. And he can tell you this Chinese person in the 8th century said this about this line, right? But you know, actually, you don't need to know any of that, you know, to experience the sutra. See? And what's important to think about is why, when this makes so little sense in terms of reason and logic, do I feel so liberated by reading it? See? So you know, one way to read the sutras is that they're philosophical statements. And the early Buddhist sutras are kind of like that. The Buddha sort of lays out a viewpoint. But you know, these later sutras are much more, I would say, sophisticated than that. They don't do that. What they do is they begin to transform your consciousness. They sort of like take you out of ordinary ways of thinking, and they start liberating you from those ordinary ways of thinking. See? And it's like reading the Diamond Sutra is like a meditation in itself. You know, I don't know if we'll ever have to ever have the chance to do this as a group. But a few years ago, Keith and I read the Flower Ornament Sutra, which is 1,500 pages. We could do like 50 pages a week. It took a couple of years. It took like 3 years or something, you know. You know, when you read it, it actually, it's like meditation. You read like a couple pages, and it's actually like meditating. It's taking you out of ordinary consciousness. And it's showing you how to experience the world in a different way. It's actually leading you there. And the Diamond Sutra does that too. You know, and it seems to me that Master Mumon is kind of getting at the same thing, right? I mean, when a monk says, does a dog have Buddha nature, he's expecting Master Mumon to explain a principle of Buddhist psychology, right, or Buddhist philosophy. So Master Mumon could have said, oh yes, all sentient beings are endowed with Buddha nature or possess Buddha nature. But you know, that's not going to liberate the monk from this world of understanding and even perception that is fundamentally mistaken, right? Fundamentally mistaken. And so what Master Mumon does is simply say mu, which means emptiness. So before we get into mu, I just want to say a little bit more about, you know, the Diamond Sutra. You know, the Diamond Sutra and this koan do something very similar. You know, the Diamond Sutra does it slowly and step by step. But the Diamond Sutra actually keeps introducing Buddhist ideas that everybody in the first century of the Common Era would have accepted as true. Like Dana is the first paramita. It's the first virtue, you could say, or the first perfection. So in Buddhism, there are these the practices that we use to wake up, one of them is dana, or generosity, giving. And it starts by discussing dana. That's why it's the first paramita, the first form of moral or moral excellence or cultivation. And then it shows that everything we thought about giving is completely incorrect. And it leaves us in a strange place. We know, at the end of reading what the Buddha says about giving and generosity, we no longer know anything about giving and generosity. And actually, this is extremely liberating. Why is it liberating? People in our world, in the modern world, generally think that they're in touch most of the time with reality. Right? We really do. Most people think they're in touch with reality about 90% of the time. And you might say, well, I had a little too much to drink, so, my perceptions were clouded. Or, if you're very stressed, you might get to work and realize you don't have any socks on or something like that, So we understand that under stress, our perceptions are distorted. If we drink, they're distorted. If we smoke dope, they're distorted. But we pretty much assume that everything we think about the world is basically accurate. When we are suffering psychologically, let's say, we might, and it's a good idea, we might go to a therapist, and the therapist would say, let me help you to get back to sort of like a more accurate understanding of the way things are. That's what a lot of people think therapists are doing. So, most people feel they're living in the real world, but actually, the Buddhist view is that people rarely live in the real world. We rarely live, it's almost never that we actually encounter reality. And that seems like such a strange thing to say, but from the Buddhist standpoint, what we see is something we have made collectively as human beings, as a society, and also individually as individual people. So, our experience of reality isn't unmediated; it's highly structured and processed before we ever get to reality. In fact, we never get to reality. We're mostly looking at all of these screens. There are so many examples of this, but years ago, I remember when I was in Seattle, I went to see this movie by this Japanese filmmaker. And the movie was about a girl in Tokyo who goes out to the countryside where her grandmother lives, her grandfather's dead. And she's a city girl that starts out in Tokyo, she's in Tokyo. She's like a schoolgirl. She just, decides to go out and see her grandma. And her grandmother lives far from Tokyo in this old farm, this old minka. And she's a modern person. This movie was made before the internet, actually. But, she listens to the radio. She has like radio, plug-in radio in her ear. And she watches TV and all of this. She goes out and there's this farm and it's so unlike the world she knows, right? It's an old style Japanese farm. The floors are covered with tatami mats. They're these woven grass mats. The walls are sliding shoji screens, right? There's no central heating, right? When it's summer, you open the screens and let the breeze blow through. Anyway, there's a scene where her grandmother's friend comes, it's raining, and her grandmother's friend comes to visit. And the granddaughter is, watching this and sort of off to the side, and we're seeing it, we're seeing what the granddaughter sees. But the the scene is this old lady, they're two like old Japanese women. They meet, and the grandmother serves her friend tea. And then they sit with in the Japanese style with their legs under them. And the grandmother opens the tatami mat. And they're both sitting there drinking, they drink their tea and then they put it down and they just sit watching the rain fall. And the movie actually like lets us just sit there for a while and watch the rain fall. They don't move, they're just absorbed into the moment of watching the rain fall. And the interesting thing about this part of the movie is that, you know, eventually the guest, the old lady, just gets up and she leaves and they never say a word to each other, right? And, you know, watching this is like, it's like a revelation, we would say, right? You know, when we meet somebody, we say something to them. I'm not criticizing, right? I do it too, right? But, you know, when we meet somebody, we feel that we need to exchange language in order to connect. And we feel that it's unsociable not to do that, even if it's trivial. Say, hey, how's it going? How are the kids? You know, whatever. You know, but you know, actually, that is a very shallow way of encountering somebody. You know, it's like, you know, actually, to encounter, you know, when we sit together in zazen, you know, we aren't exchanging any ideas, we aren't saying anything. I feel that I have some of the deepest, my sense of intimate connection is deepest with people with whom I have done meditation. So, you know, when I started sitting at the Seattle Zen Center, I used to think, oh, who are these people, who cares, right? And then after sitting with them for a couple years, I felt closer to those people than I felt to my own family. And one of my friends who just recently died, a guy named Steve Weinberg, you know, we used to sit together all the time and we used to go to Sesshin and sit next to each other. And you know, if somebody had said to me, what does Steve do for a living? I couldn't have told you. But I felt more connected to Steve than I felt to my own brother, right? Really. And I'm not putting my brother down. You know, sitting in silence, in the heart mind, in samadhi with somebody is so intimate. So again, I'm not putting Western civilization down too much. but what I'm saying is that, you know, when these two women got together, they were equipped by maybe their upbringing and their experience to realize that that actually, you know, exchanging words is a shallow way to engage with somebody. You know, and if we, you know, somebody might say, in our culture might say, oh, isn't the rain beautiful? And somebody said, oh, yes, it's beautiful. Or they would say, well, I don't like rain. So this was a totally different way of relating to the world. You know, they sat in silence, absorbed in the rain falling over the rice fields, right? And they got up and left in silence. So it's not a question of right or wrong, but you know, the thing is, our life is highly structured at every level. Really, at every level, and it's totally, from the Buddhist standpoint, totally artificial. You know, we encounter this sometimes when we go to other places, other cultures, and we suddenly realize people do totally different, respond totally differently to things than we do, right? Sometimes. But you know, there's something thrilling about experiencing animals, right? I find, right? We have a fox that comes every morning to our house, every morning. I leave an egg out for the fox every night. It's always in the same place. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it for years and years. And, you know, if I put it out at 6 o'clock, if I come back at 7, it's gone. So the fox is waiting for the egg, right? They love, foxes love eggs. So I have been doing this for years and years. It's like, and the egg is never there in the morning. The fox comes every time. And around 9:30, the fox, I think it's a female, she comes every morning and tries to capture, and eat a squirrel. There's a lot of squirrels. And, you know, basically, it's thrilling to encounter animals. And one of the things that's thrilling is we're sort of getting a glimpse of another way of looking at the world. You know, it's impossible to imagine how a fox experiences reality. And you know, actually, you really can't say we experience reality, but the fox doesn't, right? I really don't think you can say that. It's like, you know, birds can navigate using the Earth's gravitational field, right? Magnetic field, right? Birds go all over the world because they're aware of the Earth's magnetic field, and they can actually navigate it right across the globe. We can't do that. I can't even, you know, I get lost in Somerset, New Jersey, right? So look, you know, bees have what, like hundreds of eyes? You know, you could say, well, they, 2 eyes is reality. 100 eyes, that's not reality, right? I mean, I think if we're somewhat open-minded about it, we'll say, you know, the bees' reality is very different from ours, but it's fully reality for them. And our reality, you know, is a reality for us, right? But our reality is actually very, and the bee's reality too, you know, it leaves out a huge amount. You know, the bee will never know what it's like to see the world with 2 eyes. You know, some animals will never know what it's like to see with color. We'll never know what it's like to feel the Earth's, you know, magnetic field, right? The pulse of the magnetic field. We'll never know. I'm losing my hearing, so I'm losing the higher pitched sounds. I can't hear very well. You know, elephants communicate all the time. We can't hear it most of the time because it's below our threshold. And of course, lots of animals, even like mice, communicate. We hear their squeaks, but they're actually communicating a lot more. We just can't hear it. It's above, it's too high for our ears to pick up. So, you know, from the Buddhist standpoint, our world is highly artificial, and it's structured on every level. It's not just that our thoughts are artificial, right? It's not just our thought. We know language doesn't really do justice. So if I say apple, that doesn't really describe an apple, right? The word apple can't express what an apple is. So much of the apple escapes from the word. But from the Buddhist standpoint, even our experience of the apple is limited by our assumptions and our preparation. See, and I think we know this. You know, it's like, you can drive, you can spend the day walking through a field of flowers. You know, and they're just flowers. You know, you're on your way to something else. And then one day you look down and you experience the flower in a way that is impossible to describe. It's like the boundary between you and the flower disappears. And this is a totally different relationship to the flower, right? And we have these little moments where we step out of the ordinary reality of human beings and our ordinary subjective reality. And we realize, you know, in a way, it's so impoverished, right? You know, one of the things that happens to people, say, when they, like, go on vacation, you know, people will just, you know, they'll be in the rut and they'll say, why don't we go and do something, right? And my sister my sister's husband is a nurse, and my sister's a nurse practitioner also. They both work in the health profession, and he has a ex-military background and has had some traumatic experiences. And he has been, he doesn't really like to fly. He has all these, he's developed because of his really challenging past. He has like phobias about flying. So they're finally going to the, these, they're called the Turks and Caicos Island. I have no idea what they are, but my sister, they're actually going to, my brother-in-law's name is Barney Bernard. She's going to like drug Barney and on the plane and conk him out so he won't have a panic attack. And then they'll, when they have to go, they'll like wheel him out from the airport in a wheelchair. Really, she's planned it all out. It's gonna, you know, so many people do things like that. They'll go someplace that's totally new and they'll say, oh my God, you know, life could be totally different, right? You know, we have to live a different way. And then they come home, and it like pretty soon they're back in the same routine, right? But they have this experience, they suddenly realize the way we live is not reality. And actually, you know, Zen practice involves like gradually. In psychoanalysis, there's this term called derealization. Derealization. And derealization in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy is also often a negative term, right? So the idea is that people who are suffering from a psychological crisis often derealize. So suddenly things seem very dreamlike and unreal. And you know that they begin to act out or do something, and you know basically the therapist's job is to restore their confidence in their access to realities. But you know, actually, at the end of the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, "You, how should you look at reality?" He says, "How should you look at you know, if you're fully awake, how should you look at reality?" And the Buddha says, "You should look at it as a dream, a bubble, a fantasy." Right? It's like a star in the sky. You know, he says, derealize. Derealize. That's what the sutra is really about. And you know, there is a way of derealizing which is not mentally healthy. But from the Buddhist standpoint, you can't be mentally healthy unless you derealize. Unless you realize that all of these things that we think of are solid and real are not solid and real. You know, it's in the same way that, you know, it's not natural to contact somebody when you first meet somebody by throwing language at them. You know, that may be highly artificial. You know, lots of people can't stand silence. You know, it's actually terrifying to be in silence, right? So anyway, derealization is like a very important aspect of Buddhist practice. Because the idea is that the values of our culture and even the way we see the world are very defective, really defective, and really cause suffering and destruction. Right? So, you know, actually, a lot of Zen practice involves derealization. And, you know, if you have been practicing Zen for a while, you know that our kind of derealization has like this amazing, liberating, and connective effect. Right? So you know, if you are like me and you're working on your word processor, and you drink tea, you know, I go through like a gallon of tea a day, right? Every time I feel like my brain is sagging, I just run downstairs and make another cup of tea. And by the end of the day, you know, I've had a lot of tea. You know, if somebody said, how did you enjoy your tea? It's like, what, you know, I don't know. I wasn't really present to enjoy my tea. But, you know, when we sit for an hour and a half on Friday night and then serve tea. It's like, oh my God, this tea. See, so, you know, it's like stripping away all of that structure, all of those, it's like all of these presuppositions, all of these structures, this, you know, this, all these screens make reality fuzzy and easily accessible, but not increasingly unreal to us, right? And, you know, when we go into emptiness, even for a couple of minutes during a 80-minute period of meditation, you know, and you drink that tea, it's like, oh my God, people will actually say, people will come here for the first time, they say, what was that tea? And it's true, one of our former members who is from Jilin, you know, Jilin in North China, sent us a care package of some really delicious tea that we're drinking now. But you know, sometimes it's just been Lipton, which is, as many people know, the worst tea in the universe, right? And I drink it too all the time, but experts tell me terrible. Right? But the thing is, you know, if it's just Lipton and you've been meditating for 80 minutes, you know, now it's delicious. It is, you know, it's just a prejudice to say Lipton's tea is the lousiest tea. You know, when we are, we're humans, the way we live is that we create, we screen out a great deal of all the inputs, and we take the little bit that we don't screen out and we combine it in a way that seems familiar to us. And we screen out almost everything, and what we keep, we combine in ways that seem right to us or familiar to us. But, you know, actually, the reality we make is not neutral. It's shaped by our karma, right? Both individually and collectively, right? So, you know, my sisters, I'm sure she won't mind if I talk about this. My parents got divorced, and my sister really felt abandoned by my father, who pretty much abandoned his family. And my sister was at an age where that was really shocking and painful to her. So, you know, she has a wonderful husband now, but some of her boyfriends were really, I thought, my brother and I both didn't like her boyfriends, you know. Because in a way, you know, she was kind of like repeating certain aspects of her relationship to my father. We could see it, you know, and she couldn't see it. You know, she was bringing to this desire for love all of this baggage that was shaping in unhealthy ways her relationship with a couple of men who my brother and I really disliked, you know. And tried to warn her off, you know, get away from that guy, you know, he's no good for you. You know, fortunately, she didn't listen to us, but fortunately, she figured it out, right? And we see these things all the time, right? You see people trapped in the past, creating their present in ways that wind up repeating the past, even though they're trying to change things. See? That's the essence of samsara. Samsara means, in Buddhism, this word samsara is like the world of ordinary unhappiness. Samsara means to go around and around in a circle, right? And, you know, my sister was trapped in a samsaric relationship. She couldn't get out of, you know, and we can understand, like, in the context of a romantic relationship, how this could be, but all, from the Buddhist standpoint, all of our relationships have this character. Everything we do is not neutral or realistic, right? It's all colored by, we screen out almost everything, and we combine what's left in ways that reflect our limitations, our fears, and our attachments. And this is true as a culture too, right? So it's been such a struggle, right, to change the way Americans think about anything, right? And the reason it's such a struggle is because people, being people, bring all of these fears and attachments to things that should be pretty simple, right? You know, when I was a young man, there was an attempt to pass a law called the Equal Rights Amendment that said women and men are legally equal and have equal rights under law. Yes, that was the law, right? It was like this was when I was just able to vote and so on. They wanted to amend the Constitution and include a law that said men and women are legally equal, right? That's basically, if you read the language. And it didn't pass, right? It created a firestorm of terror in some people's minds. They said, well, does that mean we all have to use the same bathroom? And it's like, well, in Japan, people use the same bathroom. You know, they bathe together, right? So that wouldn't be so terrible, but it was terrifying, right? What was so terrifying about saying men and women will have the same rights under law? Just people are, it's not just their, it's all, we all do this all the time. So you know, Momon is saying something really important, that we can't be awake if we don't derealize. Yeah, if we don't Zen is about derealization and then reintegration. Zen is, again and again, derealization and then integration. You know, if you derealize, you go back to zero, right? Mu is like going back to the zero point. It's like starting your life again, back to this emptiness. You go into that emptiness, and you know, you walk outside, and before you didn't even pay attention, and you know, but when you walk outside, you feel connected to the blades of grass on the ground, right? Or you feel cold on your face, and instead of recoiling, you feel yourself disappear. Just disappear. And when you disappear, you feel connected to everything around you. So, you know, deconstruction of our reality and reconstruction of our reality all depends on being able to go into emptiness. And, you know, the Diamond Sutra is really saying, you know, you have to, liberation begins by seeing how artificial the world we have made and live in really is. And for some people that's terrifying. But, you know, the thing is, when you read the Diamond Sutra, you know, every time it throws a wrench into your assumptions, you know, I think you, if you examine yourself and say, well, do I understand what he's talking about? And he says, no. But then if you say, well, how do I feel about it? It's like, oh, I feel great. Actually, I'm so happy, you know. And why are you happy? Because you're getting out of your cage a little bit, right? You know. And at the end, you know, to say, you know, if you follow the Diamond Sutra's advice, you'll see everything as a dream and a fantasy and unreal. You think that sounds like a nightmare, but it's not. It's the beginning of wisdom. You derealize in order to make contact with the real world, right? And when you do that, you begin the process of reintegration. So a lot goes on when we enter emptiness. Every time we enter emptiness and we come out again, we have the chance to experience the world differently. And, you know, habit is so powerful, we don't always do that. You know, but the more we go into that emptiness and the more we immerse ourselves in that mu and then we come out and we experience, the greater the chances are that the world will be different when we emerge. And you go through that process for 50 years, and it's a promise, you know, it's a very different world, very, very amazing, magical, astonishing world. It's like, it's so liberating to let go of everything. A monk asked Joshu, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" Joshu answered, "Moo." I hope I can't help myself. I have to read this one more time. In order to master Zen, you must pass the barrier of the ancestors. To attain this subtle realization, you must completely cut off the way of thinking. If you do not pass the barrier and do not cut off the way of thinking, you will be like a ghost clinging to bushes and weeds. No offense, but that's most human beings, right? That's most human beings. Now, I want to ask you, what is the barrier of the ancestors? Why it is this single word, mu? That is the front gate to Zen. Therefore, it is called the gate of no barrier. If you pass through it, you will not only see Joshu face to face, but you will also go hand in hand with the successive ancestors, entangling your eyebrows with theirs, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. You know, when you go into emptiness and you hear the sound of a bird, see, that's the way the Buddha experienced the sound of the bird. That's the way Joshu experienced the sound of the bird. Isn't that a delightful prospect? Wouldn't you like to pass this barrier? So arouse your entire body with its 360 bones and joints and 84,000 pores of the skin. Summon up a spirit of great doubt. See, derealize. And concentrate on this word mu. Carry it continuously day and night. Do not form a nihilistic conception of vacancy or a relative conception of has and has not. You know, it's challenging. It will be just as if you swallowed a red-hot iron ball, which you cannot spit out even if you try. All the illusory ideas and delusive thoughts accumulated up to the present will be wiped out. And when the time comes, the inner world and the outer world, you could say the conscious and the unconscious, will be united. You will know this, but for yourself only, like a man who can't speak, who has had a dream. Then, all of a sudden, an explosive conversion will occur, and you will astonish the heavens and shake the earth. That's the energy you experience when you go into emptiness. It will be as if you snatch away the great sword of the valiant general Kan U and hold it in your hand. See, no ideas. When you meet, quote unquote, the Buddha, you kill him. When you meet the, quote unquote, ancestors, you kill them. On the brink of life and death, you command perfect freedom. Actually, there is no life, and there is no death. There is no such thing as life, and there is no such thing as death. Among the sixfold worlds and four modes of existence, you enjoy a playful samadhi. Now, I want to ask you again, how will you carry it out? Employ every ounce of your energy to work on this move. If you hold on without interruption, behold a single spark, and the sacred light is ignited. Mumon's verse, the dog, the Buddha nature, the pronouncement, perfect and final. Before you say it has or has not, you are a dead man on the spot.